and welcome back to the How to Be Good podcast, the show where we interview people and businesses that are helping to combat the climate change and live a more sustainable life. I'm Gareth, and with me is Anka. On our show this week, we have the co-founder and the executive director of Wild Coast, that being Serge Dedina. And we also have Matt Costa from Scripps Institution of Oceanography. Serge's achievements are huge. He has helped stop efforts for large-scale development and tourism and marinas and things like that in national parks and protected areas. He's also launched a wildly successful Don't Eat Sea Turtle campaign. He's also helped develop millions of acres of protected coastline around California and Mexico. He's also developed a campaign with the rock superstars Linkin Park around natural climate solutions. And this is just some of his long list of 20-something years in campaigning for environmental factors.
Matt Costa is a postdoctoral scholar for Scripps, which is the Integrity of Oceanography Division, where he has been researching mangrove forests, conservation, climate change adaptation, sediment biogeochemistry, coastal ecology, and blue carbon. As well as working alongside Serge and Wild Coast on many of their projects. Wild Coast is an amazing, amazing charity, and we are really looking forward to showing you their work, their perseverance in continuing their work throughout all the stops and changes in the United States political life.
And not just that, they're starting to get more and more global as well. They have a big, or I think roughly 50% of their staff is now in Mexico as well. So they're reaching out and they're getting bigger, and they're doing some fantastic things to help the environment. So let's get to it and listen to the show. Hello and welcome to the How to Be Good podcast. Today we are here with Serge Dedina, Executive Director of Wild Coast, and Matt Costa from Scripps Institution of Oceanography. How are you going?
Good. Good to be here.
Doing well, thanks.
That's great. It's so good to have you on the show. We'll get straight into it because we got a lot to talk about and you guys are both doing an awful lot. So, Serge, before we talk about Wild Coast, could you take us on a little journey of how you came to be both so passionate about environmental conservation?
It really starts with my parents. My mom, Josephine, grew up in London, was bombed in the Blitz during the war, spent her childhood in bomb shelters, and vivid memories of bombs raining down, kids getting blown up in her neighborhood, and the horror of war. And I talked to her before she died about her childhood, and she said that her first memory after the war, really when she was a little girl, was my Uncle Ken, who was a little older, could drive, and her sister Jill, and they left London to go to the seaside, where you could finally go to, because back then you couldn't go to the beach, right? In England, it was barbed wire. And so she never forgot that, right? And then my father was in France in 1939. My dad's Jewish. And so he remembered, before they came to America to escape the Nazi occupation of Europe, vivid memories of his being with his family at the seaside, right? Probably the last time his family was together before they were disrupted by war. And they came to New York, and again, on Coney Island at the beach. Long story short, my parents met, ended up in California in the 1960s. And I spent my childhood on the beach because my dad said, you know, we're all the same at the beach. You know, you live like a millionaire by being at the beach. It was free, right, and beautiful. So I spent my childhood in San Diego and on the beaches of Malibu, Santa Monica, all up and down the California coast. And then we moved to San Diego in 1971 when I was a little kid, and to Imperial Beach, California, where I'm still at, right on the U.S.-Mexico border. It's the last town on the California coast, surrounded by the Pacific Ocean on one side, which is now a marine protected area, and then the Tijuana Estuary National Wildlife Refuge, which is now protected, and then South San Diego Bay, another wildlife refuge. But then they weren't protected. And I spent my childhood and teen years working with my parents and other community members to get those areas protected as national wildlife refuges because they were threatened with marina development, high-rise development. In the process, I got beat up, sitting in front of bulldozers. You name it, they threw it at us, but we were victorious. And today we have a wonderful wildlife refuge that we call home, right? And, yeah. And protected all these areas. So that's how I got into conservation, started working with the Surfrider Foundation. I was in high school to stop a breakwater project. But that turned into graduate student research in Mexico and doing a PhD on gray whale conservation in Baja California, starting a career with the Nature Conservancy, helping develop national parks in Baja California, and then starting Wild Coast with a guy named Wallace J. Nichols in 2000. And that was 21 years ago, and we're still strong. And really, I think what it comes back to me is there's nothing more important than nature, our connection to nature and wild places. We preserve the Mona Lisa in a museum, but we need to have the same reverence and respect for nature, right? And wild nature. And that's what really what Wild Coast is about. And I think my journey was all about.
Absolutely. So that's fantastic. Would you say that the coast, the seaside, the ocean is your, I guess, your place of calm, your place where you sort of feel more centered than anything else?
Yeah. So, you know, as a surfer, I started surfing when I was 13 in 1977, but yeah, I need to be in water. So Wallace J. Nichols, the guy I started Wild Coast with, has written a book called Blue Mind, and really this idea that, you know, the physiology of being in water, and it's the same for me is, you know, I'm on the coast, whether it's in Australia or whether it's in Mexico, whether it's in San Diego, and I'm looking outward or under the water, you know, that's peace, right? That's, yeah. That's sereneness, it's connection. But what you see is I'm really into watching people. Watch children at the beach, right? Watch families at the beach. They're supremely happy. They are themselves. They're not the disconnected people we've created in modern society. Mm-hmm. And that is what we saw in the pandemic, more important than ever, right? Yeah. It's priceless. And it's free to all of us. And I think a lot of us recognize why that's so important for the last
Absolutely.
Year, even more
yeah.
than ever.
Yeah. I'll have to read that book because, yeah, for me, it's the place where I am without a doubt the most calm and the most at peace with everything. No matter how bad things can be elsewhere, go to the ocean, get on the water. That's where I'm calm. So, I'll have to read that book. So, Matt, over to you. How would you describe your journey?
Yeah, well, there's one actually interesting point of connection with Serge's story is that I grew up on the beach in New York City, which is as Serge mentioned, in Coney Island, I grew up in a neighborhood of New York City called Rockaway, which you know, I often tell when I tell people I grew up in a beach neighborhood in New York City, often they don't really believe me. But I think there's actually an important lesson there that coastal environments can be little pieces of wilderness or big pieces of wilderness right up against or in yeah. our biggest cities. And I had the advantage of growing up in a city like New York where I had a lot of opportunities, but also in a place where all summer I was in or at the edge or under the water looking, learning, you know, finding organisms, digging in the sand, looking for invertebrates or, you know, interesting things buried down there, playing in sand dunes and so on. And in some ways that's carried on today. I still do my research looking at in sediments for what we can learn about those coastal ecosystems. So, these coastal urban ecosystems can be really valuable from mm-hmm. sparking scientific curiosity, also for providing, as we were talking about, sort of joy and peace. I find that it, you know, now I'm a postdoctoral researcher, a very serious scientist, but still when I go in the water, a piece of me is still, I'm a kid again, you know, mm-hmm. that it's easy to remember why you get into this. But I got interested specifically in studying mangroves through a summer marine biology course in college and became really interested in mangrove conservation, understanding how important those ecosystems were, which took me to wanting to work with a professor here at Scripps named Octavio Alberto, who had been doing a lot of great mangrove conservation biology research, which led to a PhD here at Scripps, which I finished a couple of years ago. And now I'm a postdoc at Scripps Institution of Oceanography studying coastal ecosystems and their carbon sequestration. So it's
fantastic.
Been a journey.
It's so good. I'm so jealous. I think both of you got the career that I wish I had have done, but didn't. But there we go. It is what it is. So, Serge, could you tell us about Wild Coast? Its inception, its mission, and you know what you are achieving and what you want to achieve.
Yeah, so just to lay it out, Wild Coast is an international conservation team that conserves coastal and marine ecosystems and wildlife and addresses climate change through natural solutions. So, you know, what does that mean? It means we're interested in protecting amazingly important coastal and marine ecosystems and island ecosystems and the wildlife there, whether it's through setting up parks, federal conservation concessions, different means to protect places, working with local stakeholders and agencies and government agencies to help protect them, to steward them, and then really then help develop the policies we need that are maybe immediately enacted in Mexico City or Washington, but actually help solve problems on the ground. And really, it came out of graduate work. I did my PhD in Baja California I'm a geographer on gray whale conservation. And then met a guy named Wallace J. Nichols, who's doing his PhD at the University of Arizona on sea turtles. And so we crossed paths. I was finding dead sea turtles on the Pacific coast of Baja California. They were being slaughtered by the thousands. And Jay was in the Gulf of California looking for sea turtles and couldn't find him. And I said, hey, look, you need to come over to the Pacific because we're finding sea turtles being slaughtered everywhere. We connected. And then in 2000, we decided that we really needed to form an organization that could first help protect these amazingly important wild ecosystems we are still seeing in Baja. And, you know, think of Western Australia, the northern part of Western Australia, the coast. This is desert. These are desert landscapes with these lagoons and coastline filled with whales. You have pronghorn antelope on the coast, vast expanses of nature, right? Populated, sparse populations of ranchers and fishermen, people who live on the edge of the wilderness and make their living from the sea or from the desert. So really remarkable places. But we really wanted to figure out ways to work with government agencies and local communities and other nonprofits to figure out how to protect these areas. Some were already protected, and then stop things like the slaughter. So, you know, that's how we started. But today we've got a staff of over 20 offices in the United States and Mexico, from San Diego, Ensenada, which is in northern Baja, in La Paz in southern Baja, California, and then in Oaxaca as well. And so we're working to really help protect key areas. So the big projects we have are we're protecting a wilderness called Los Cirios, which is a vast area over 100 miles long. Think of West Oz. It's West Oz. Almost nobody lives there. Yeah. And we've protected over 35 miles of coastline through acquisitions. We own about close to over 35,000 acres of land there, but in partnership with the National Park Service of Mexico. And then this really important project to protect mangroves, right? Mangrove ecosystem, these mangrove lagoons on the Pacific coast of Mexico and up around the Gulf of California, where you have gray whales go. Some of the most remarkable and most productive coastal marine ecosystems on the planet. And then we have a big project to protect coral reefs in the Pacific of Mexico, areas that haven't been bleached yet. Yeah. Some have been impacted by human use, but some like Cabo Pulmo, where Matt's professor and arguably one of the most esteemed conservationists on the planet, Octavio Alberto, has really did some groundbreaking work and conservation to help protect this coral reef that is considered the world's most productive marine protected area, where fish have come back by 500%. It's what Jacques Cousteau was filming back in the 50s, right? And so that's been really remarkable. And then finally, what's been really moving, I think, and inspiring is going back to California and helping protect an area about 500,000 acres, probably about 150,000 hectares of marine protected areas up and down the California coast, and then really focus on strengthening the management of those areas. We have radar dishes on the coast on the coast to stop poachers. Unfortunately, one of the wealthiest communities where Matt is in La Jolla, California, we have the Scripps Institution of Oceanography. We get these poachers to descend at night to steal lobster. And in fact, there's a radar dish on Matt's pier, on Scripps Pier, to track poachers. And so we've been working with California authorities to crack down on those guys and prosecute, with district attorneys to prosecute people stealing from marine protected areas. We're talking about tens of thousands of dollars of a lobster. Yeah. And then finally, some of these marine protected areas are coastal wetlands. And with thanks to this partnership of Matt and the support of the San Diego Foundation and the California Ocean Protection Council and other donors, we're trying to really identify the contribution of these ecosystems. And Matt will talk about that. But to helping mitigate and the climate crisis and sequester carbon. And what we're finding is a really, really remarkable ecosystem. So my philosophy is, to address the climate crisis, we need to preserve and protect every inch of blue and green space on the planet. That's Absolutely. It. Like, that's a minimum, right? And we have to deal with all the smokestack stuff. But what we're finding out is these ecosystems that we were forgotten or we didn't value are now critical in our effort to save and address the climate crisis.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Serge, so you've obviously been doing this for quite a few years with Wild Coast. What have been your favorite projects or your favorite project?
Yeah, I think there's a few. First, it's really moving and inspiring to me to protect these, I guess I'm going to say, and Matt, I think you really nailed it, these urban ecosystems, right? Like, right off of where Matt is at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography in La Jolla is, this ocean, blue ocean wilderness, right? You've got this deep trench right offshore with amazing congregations of sharks, blue whales offshore, leopard sharks in a beach, one of the most important leopard shark spawning sites or habitats in Southern California, maybe one of the most important on the West Coast. That's filled with thousands of people every weekend, right? So really, that's been really, really remarkable. And then to see that in our marine protected areas in California, things are doing well. Like I go out in the water in La Jolla where it's pretty protected. Sea turtles have come back. I go surf at a reef called Bird Rock, where it's a marine protected area. We actually have a radar dish near there. And I see more fish than I do as many fish as I do in Baja. So I think that's really exciting. I think a lot of scientists talk about it takes, and I think this is what came out in Cabo Pulmo with the research of Octavio Alberto and others, really almost 8 to 10 years, 9 to 10 years for fish to start coming back when you stop fishing in an area. So that's what we're seeing in California. But, Baja California, where we're working and we've worked for a while, we've worked to preserve an area that has a lot of mangroves, San Ignacio Lagoon or Laguna San Ignacio. It's UNESCO World Heritage Site and a whale reserve. And I was involved in that doing my PhD there, wrote a book called Saving the Gray Whale about it. One of the world's first whale refuges was created there. And whales are friendly. Fishermen are organized in cooperatives to help take people whale watching, so they benefit from ecotourism. But we worked in partnership with other NGOs and conservation organizations and the Mexican government and local people to protect about 450,000 acres of ecosystems around Lagoon, including every inch of the mangroves there, to stop development threats. Because the Mitsubishi Corporation back in the 90s had proposed building a vast industrial salt harvesting facility there, so to turn this wilderness into an industrial site. So that we've been working there for a long time, and it's really borne fruit. Like we've really seen the effort of collaborating with local folks, focusing on ecosystems and sustainable economic activities that, hardscrabble ranchers turned fishermen turned whale watching guides can carry out. And you've seen that when you work with people who are committed to the environment, but making a living from it, and you focus on what sustainability means in terms of their livelihoods and protecting a resource, you can actually figure out how to make human activities compatible with nature. So I think that's been great. And then to see things like Cabo Pulmo, where, scientists and conservationists and local fishermen, again, fishermen and dive guides have come together to stop fishing. They gave up fishing. Remarkable, right?
Yeah.
These are guys, I mean, make sure we're clear on the Baja California that we work in. These are plywood houses on the shoreline, no electricity, except with solar panels. There's no grocery store nearby. They're driving old trucks, right, to get to schools, et cetera. And they decided to give up fishing for ecotourism. They wanted to save a coral reef, right? Like really, really great stuff. And then I'll end with Oaxaca, where the World Surf League is going to have a big surf contest soon in July. Bar La Cruz, one of the world's most famous surf spots. But it's also part of a network of indigenous communities and tropical forest and sea turtle nesting beaches. So think of Kauai, right? Like beautiful, dry tropical forest, wet after the rainy season, green after the rainy season, vast watersheds that go up into the mountains. And there are beaches there that 1 million turtles nest on every year because the local residents, indigenous people, have decided that they stopped the trade in sea turtles and decided to become sea turtle conservationists. Really, really inspiring. So those are really, I think, some of the hallmarks of things we're working on. And, and if you're listening to this around the world, the news on Mexico is never good, right? Like, but the Mexico that I've been working on for the last 30 years and 40 years and live next to is a very different place than what you see in the media, filled with inspiring, dedicated people. And I know you know this, Matt, because, you work there as well, who are really committed to saving the environment and helping their communities. They're the quiet folks that do the great, the important work that keep things going. And they're the ones that make conservation happen, and they're the ones that we work with. So I think that's been the most important part of this. And to throw something out to Matt, what I love about working with Matt and also his fellow colleagues from the Scripps Institute of Oceanography, one of the most renowned scientific institutions for oceanographic research on the planet, is at the end of the day, they just love getting their feet dirty, like in wet. Mm-hmm. Like when you're in the field with these guys, men and women, they're so excited about science. Like, and I see that, Matt, with you when you're in the field, like, it's really infectious. And I think what we've learned, at least in our country, is that, God, science is important.
Yeah. Oh, it is. We need to listen to it a lot more.
scientists that understand the importance of communicating with the public and working with folks in Mexico and on the ground, like that. And you're a great teacher, Matt. I think that's something that I really, you know, you've partnered with our staff, you're really patient, and you're really good at explaining. And you can see the infectious joy that you have for in scientific inquiry, which I think is, you know, I'm a nerd, right? Like, I think that's really cool. So anyway.
Well, thank you for that. And I like, as I said, you know, whenever I'm back in the water, it's like being a kid again, just trying to find a new creature in the sand. But I consider myself lucky that I am privileged that I study something that is in some ways so easy to share the beauty of with people. People want to know about nature. They, you know, I think deep down it's a really great gift to be able to share that with people, whether it's online on some kind of video stream as we've done during quarantine to in person. That's a big part of the appeal for me.
Talking about science, I couldn't help but turning this a little bit political. We have seen so many protected areas being overturned during Trump's presidency. Has this affected you and your protected areas?
So I'm on the Wild Coast. We have an office right on the U.S.-Mexico border. And so if you have any images in your head and, you know, what happened over the last 4 years with the U.S.-Mexico border, there's, you know, I can go down to the beach and see a giant wall that goes out into the ocean. But at one point, I was actually on my surf skis. I have an Australian-style surf ski out in a marine protected area just offshore from the Tijuana Estuary, about a mile from the border. I saw a naval ship, right? It's when our Department of Homeland Security person was there. There were people trying to climb over the fence. And I say that because all of that drama, all of that political insecurity, all of the derision for the environment and for science obviously got in the way. And all that drama and all that conflict, all that tension, and it was really ugly and painful. And, you know, I'll focus on what happened with Bears Ears National Monument in Utah, for example, where, you know, First Nations folks and Native Americans had worked with conservationists and the United States government to create this national monument for a place that a landscape, if you haven't been to Southern Utah, it's, you know, one of the world's most remarkable landscapes that is, has deep meaning. And I think that's something we're learning about conservation, is that, you know, these indigenous or First Nations landscapes, cultural landscapes that are deeply meaningful to people, right? That have embedded meaning and, you know, have had meaning for thousands of years. I think the pain that they felt when that was overturned, right? But now the joy that they're feeling now that that's back to being protected, I think is important. But it's hard to understate the insecurity many of us in the environmental movement felt. The tension, the anger, the attacks that we felt, and the need for support. We had a group of foundations that got us together in meetings with a facilitator to say, hey, guys, we understand. It's been tough, right? And especially on the U.S.-Mexico border, where we had a tsunami of sewage and trash coming across the border from Tijuana, but we're basically helpless and never getting any help from the Trump administration until the last minute to address this issue, right? And meanwhile, they're building a border wall, right, that was literally falling apart. So, not good stuff. And, you know, I think what's also real painful for us is that the attacks on Mexico, you know, I have a binational team. We're half U.S., half Mexican staff.
Yeah.
And really amazing, inspiring people that work for us. And, I think it pained them to see the United States government attacking Mexico and the animosity. But more importantly, for me, you know, when that's happening, we're not doing conservation, right? Like, and so but I think what we all saw during that period was that, you know, I have friends in the Fish and Wildlife Service who work for the federal government, is people who are committed to conservation and the environment, people in NGOs and conservation organizations, people in communities, kept doing the work, right? The work of democracy. And I always say conservation is democracy, and it needs democracy to flourish. And I found that really inspiring and moving. And, you know, that's the only thing that was sort of like what we had to work on.
Are things changing now that Joe Biden is in power? And do you see Wild Coast being able to protect more areas from now on?
Yeah. So look, things have calmed down a lot in the United States. I think, you know, for obviously some folks who are listening are maybe really unhappy, but just the tension has dialed down. I think we're just getting back to the business of government, right, where it's not a daily drama. And I think that's important. And I know for us and our federal partners, we, you know, we work with everybody from NOAA to the National Marine Fisheries Service, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. They're back to doing the work, National Park Service, and they're back to doing the work they need to do, right? So I think things are getting back on track. You know, it's hard to describe the disruption that many assets, I guess, agencies of the federal government, civil service suffered at the hands of mismanagement and inattention. So I think that's going to take some time, but I think we're moving in the right direction. And you saw the federal government has overturned efforts to do oil drilling off the coast or banning that, for example. Yes. I think that's really important. So there's been a lot of good movement. And I think we have a great Secretary of the Interior, our first Native American Secretary of the Interior, who's in charge of the National Park Service and Conservation and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. So I think things like that are really positive. But it's going to take some time. And Mexico is still challenging. And the United States-Mexico relationship is very challenging right now because of the immigration crisis and all kinds of things happening. So it'll take some time to get back on track. But, you know, that's why citizen conservation, the role of scientists, the role of local governments, the role of NGOs is so critical when you have these disruptions in civil society, right, and government.
That's absolutely. It's almost been, it's been maybe 4 years of things. It was almost like a drama series with Trump. 4 years of a drama series where we couldn't get on with the work that needed to be get on with because we're constantly fighting silly dramas that have been cooked up all the time. And I think the world over thought it was pretty devastating, but obviously more so in the States than anywhere else.
You know, if you look at what's happening in Brazil with the Amazon, you know, Venezuela, you know, we forget about Venezuela. You know, we focus on what's happening in Venezuela with politics. We forget it's one of the most after Brazil, one of the most biodiverse and, you know, a tropical forest rich country in the world, also filled with mangroves. The Orinoco River enters in the Atlantic and just been devastated, right? So there's so many places that have suffered as a result of the turn to authoritarianism and lack of democracy and the inability of NGOs and civil society to help protect your backyard habitats, right? So it's going to be a challenge for some time to come. You know, Europe's facing these challenges. Let's face it, Australia as well, with the obsession with, you know, the coal industry, et cetera. Yeah. So we've got a lot of work to do to address climate change. But, you know, so we all have a lot of work to do and we have to continue to press. And I say something like this, we never apologize for doing conservation ever. We don't apologize. You know, people attack us as tree huggers. Great. I love hugging trees. You know, I want to hug a whale. I can. But, you know, that's sacred work, right? Like really important stuff. And so, as I ever, one of our donors said, who said it was supposed to be easy.
Absolutely.
One comment I can make on the significance of the changing political situation in the U.S. in the last 4 years. Pretty much the time that I was a PhD candidate was during the Trump administration. And I, at Scripps, I had the wonderful opportunity to participate in a few international meetings through the UN, for instance, the UN, what's called the COP or Conference of the Parties for the UN Climate Change Organization, UNFCCC. So I got to go to these international meetings and learn about the process of international climate negotiations and what happens behind those doors and understanding that process. And people from all over the world come. Delegates, negotiators, also NGOs, advocates come and talk and meet at these meetings. And coming to those meetings during 2018 and 19 as a U.S., someone from the United States of America, some people looked at you like, oh, you're here. You know, there's this, you guys are here. And that realized there was this really, after the important role that the Obama administration had played in the Paris Climate Agreement, there's a huge vacuum of American leadership that happened in the last 4 years. Just in that somewhat symbolic international negotiation sense, and symbolically at least, and hopefully in action, that is going to change again, because clearly there is a much bigger emphasis on the importance of looking to sustainability as a source of economic revitalization and so on in the new administration. So I'm hoping that the next grad students who get to learn about this from the United States have a somewhat different experience going to those meetings. But it was an interesting education in domestic and international politics.
Absolutely. I think, unfortunately, the Australian government with Scott Morrison has tried to fill that void of, for want of a better word, stupidity from the Trump administration at the moment. And hopefully there's enough global pressure on them to show that they cannot go down that route. We cannot continue here going down the endless mining and burning of coal and now gas and so forth. But we'll see what happens. We'll keep pushing as we always do. So have you seen a shift in environmental activism in the last couple of years? I mean, we have noticed, perhaps as we're paying more attention, but we've noticed that there's a greater degree of activism, and it's getting a larger and greater momentum, and often brought through by perhaps the youth activism as well. So have you seen that too, and how have you seen that manifested?
Yeah, look, I think at least on the United States side, especially in California, there's a big focus on climate justice and environmental justice. I mean, really linking issues of environmental pollution to the health and safety, environmental health of mostly communities of color in low-income areas. And around the climate justice movement, especially in California, there's been a really interesting movement to look at the fact that even though California calls itself a climate leader, we're still burning fossil fuels and we have oil derricks in low-income neighborhoods right next to schools. So I think the environmentalism has gotten a lot more focused. But you're right, you see so many different facets. And I think for me, at least, the climate movement's been pretty multifaceted, from cities that are filing lawsuits against the fossil fuel industry, to these kids that are filed lawsuits, and to the environmental justice and climate justice movement. So there's a lot of pressure being put on the fossil fuel industry. I think the other interesting movement, and really, I don't know if it's activism, but it's really a market-based approach where cities are saying they're joining these sort of community power alliances. And so they're buying more clean energy to offer to their customers. And I think we all realize this, that you know, the fact that we're still in the fossil fuel business and mining for coal is crazy, since it's so expensive. And at the end of the day, solar energy and offshore energy and wind, et cetera, are a lot cheaper. Yep. And the cost is astronomically lower than continuing to destroy the planet with these expensive, crazy operations, you know, mining in remote places. But it's clear that governments are interested in serving their campaign donors, right? Mm-hmm. One thing I've learned in this pandemic, I think we've all seen, is when people want to make things happen quickly, they can. And, you know, if we want to get together and figure out the climate crisis and make a global commitment to reducing emissions and saving forests and wetlands, we could do it. But we need to have that commitment.
That's right. Yeah, absolutely. So could we talk a little about the protected area that you've got, and what specifically, you mentioned the turtles and things like that. So what other sea life is being protected in that area, and describe sort of how you protect it as well?
So, you know, Wild Coast has worked to protect, you know, millions of acres of different types of protected areas in California and Mexico. But, you know, I'll just take one, for example, in Oaxaca, in southern Mexico. You know, you've got these vast watersheds go down to these big white sandy beaches with coral reefs in the ocean, mangroves and wetlands. And so I think the approach, and where you have, you know, a humpback whales offshore. And so the approach has been, and whether it's in Baja California or California, to have these integrated conservation areas, protected areas. So you're not just protecting one ecosystem, that you're trying to protect a larger, more multifaceted area that's on land and in the ocean, and hopefully includes the watershed. So that's what you're seeing in areas where Matt's working to do carbon sampling, for example, in San Diego. You see like what's called San Diego Lagoon and other places, Batacays Lagoon, that are part of wetlands, that are part of watersheds, that may include marine protected areas. And in Baja California and Oaxaca, that's the same thing. You've got these extensive tropical forest watersheds that go down into a wetland where mangroves are, that includes a sea turtle nesting beach, a coral reef, and then, you know, humpback whale habitat and sea turtle habitat and fishing grounds offshore. So I think that's really the model. Where a lot of this comes together is these areas in Baja California where you have mangroves, for example, in the Gulf of California or in the Pacific, we have these gray whale lagoons. So you have a, let's say we have San Ignacio Lagoon, a UNESCO World Heritage Site that has extensive mangroves, but it's, you know, it's over 2 million hectares, over 6 million acres. It includes pronghorn antelope habitat and bighorn sheep habitat in the desert, two gray whale lagoons we have ringed by mangroves, sustainable fishing activities that happen, sea turtles, lobster fishermen, abalone fishermen. So very varied habitats. And a lot of those places in Mexico that are biosphere reserves are really established to sort of have that multifaceted approach. And I think in Western Australia, in the northwestern Australia, you have a lot of reserves like that, these larger, vaster areas that are really encompass all diversity of ecosystems. And I think that's really the approach now, is to have a lot of wildness encapsulated in these protected areas.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, for us, we've got in northwestern Australia, sort of the Ningaloo Reef area and stuff like that, which is, it's just an amazing abundance of wildlife, but it's a huge protected area. Unfortunately, we have offshore gas that they want to put a pipeline right through it that we're fighting at the moment, but we'll keep fighting and hopefully they don't get the go-ahead with that.
I would say that probably southern Baja California is probably more similar to northwestern Australia. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you've got things like whale sharks and, you know, sea turtles, big, you know, bigger sharks offshore, you know, these migratory wildlife corridors. Yeah. And so, you know, really big species and, you know, human activity, as well as this, you know, this really interesting desert landscape.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I would just wanted to echo and emphasize one of the points that Serge made, which was the really great importance of protecting connected sets of ecosystems. And especially when we think about coastal wetlands, very often, you know, coastal wetlands are the interface of land and sea, and they're affected very much by both land and sea. In many places we have, and from my perspective, as someone who studies sediment all the time, really a big part of the story is where the sediment comes from and where it goes. Very frequently, coastal wetlands are either starved of sediment because of either dams or changes in watersheds upstream, or they might be affected by the wrong kind of sediment being brought in by waves, or, you know, or affected by dredging and so on. And so in California, our wetlands are pretty well protected. Their footprint is pretty well protected, but it's pretty important to recognize the effects that things happening miles and miles away have on whether those ecosystems will be able to keep up with sea level rise, for instance. If we don't allow our coastal wetlands to build up sediment, they won't be able to persist under projected sea level rise. So there's great evidence of this also on the Pacific coast of Mexico and in mangroves. Some research from some of my colleagues have shown that dams hundreds of miles upstream on rivers, if they're present, cause mangrove ecosystems to recede because they're not able to keep up with erosion and sea level rise. So we have to think about the protections of these things in a connected, holistic way.
Yeah, well, that's the thing.
It's not easy.
We're all connected, and unfortunately, it's when we look at it and we do more and more research about it, the things that we do over West Coast and the things that we do over East Coast, everything affects, you know, we were seeing it with the storms with El Nino and the Nino and how that's affecting everything now. So it is it's a global picture, really, but trying to get people to think globally is quite difficult. Ankur, I think you wanted to talk about industrial fishing as well.
Yes, and also the other thing that I wanted to ask now about your protected areas, how do you manage them and how do you enforce the protected areas? Firstly, because you talked about the human interaction, especially on the developed areas, cities, ocean areas, where the human activity is present and in large numbers. How do you enforce the protected areas? How do you make sure that the turtle nestings are protected in the period of time that they need to be left alone and so on?
In Southern California, in San Diego County, where you have this system of marine protected areas, a whole connected series of marine protected areas up and down over 70 miles of coastline, off of La Jolla, near where Matt's institution is, We, you know, I think the mythology in the United States was, oh, well, everything's fine. We just set up these parks on, you know, in paper and it'll all be great. And then what we quickly realized was that these areas where there were marine protected areas where the fish started coming back and there were off limits to, for example, lobster fishermen. The lobster fishermen are respecting that, but the protection is enforced by a whole bevy of people. So California Fish and Game or Fish and Wildlife wardens, local lifeguards, you know, citizens are calling in tips to people are doing illegal activities. A lot of it is compliance, right? Doing education. Yeah. So Wild Coast has been working with, you know, the bait and tackle shops, fishing, you know, the kayaking companies, fishing companies, sport fishing companies, to do a lot of the education, printing maps and guides, all kinds of technology so people know where they're fishing and not allowed to go into marine protected areas. But one thing that we started hearing from lifeguards was about this plague of poachers that were coming in at night to steal lobster and abalone and all kinds of other things, and which we were amazed by, right? Well, how can this be happening in, you know, one of the wealthiest areas in the United States, if not the planet? And it turns out they were right. And so we worked with a foundation that has a global project to put in radars and marine protected areas along the coastlines to track poaching. And there's an effort to do this with satellites for global industrial fishing. But this is more locally based, designed to sort of like stop and track and stop smaller poaching activities. And so we had an algorithm that was developed. So you can this radar system then can identify what boat activities probably were based in poaching that would ping someone's cell phone so they could call lifeguards or California Fish and Wildlife wardens. And so what we started doing is documenting this poaching. Then we worked with district attorneys who weren't prosecuting these cases because they're like, well, who cares if a bunch of people are stealing $30,000 in one night of lobster, just crazy stuff. And started changing the law to actually increase the penalties for poaching. And the DA started in San Diego, started prosecuting these cases of pretty egregious poaching. People were coming from over 100 miles away to take lobster and make $30,000 in a night out of a marine protected area in La Jolla. So that's been something that's really critical. We have a radar dish in Cabo Pulmo, a marine protected area in southern Baja. It's a really successful marine reserve. But in Mexico, the a lot of the anti-poaching activity and protection is really based on obviously local stakeholders. So, for example, in certain areas like San Ignacio Lagoon, a lot of it depends on having local fishing co-ops and whale watching sort of permit holders who have exclusive access to those areas. So they have a financial incentive and access to that area. So they're essentially responsible for managing it, right? So in theory, they have an incentive. So it's not a commons. It's not like the tragedy of the commons where it's an open access area. Many of these areas are closed access areas. So one cooperative has exclusive access to that zone. And in San Ignacio Lagoon, we have a lot of mangroves, for example. You have collective agrarian cooperatives that own the land, even though it's in a national park. And so only they can go there. And so we've been working with them to help protect these mangroves. Whale watching is the same thing. Only local people can get access to those permits. They have an incentive to manage it very well. And then in just north of this lagoon, we probably have some of the most well-managed community-based fisheries on the planet, where communities have been working for over 70 years in cooperatives, and each cooperative has sole access to that zone. They have guys in boats with guns that stop people in cartels, the narco cartels, who are also involved in poaching. Pretty heavy stuff, right? But there's that part of the enforcement, and then there's the good part of the compliance, which is trying to create incentives for people to do the right thing. And I think in San Diego, you know, we've got this MPA collaborative that's been working with all kinds of institutions and agencies to sort of create these overlays and layers of protection and conservation. So I think that's been really important. And obviously, you need to work with the fishing industry in that as well. And overall, obviously, the fishing industry wants to do the right thing. They don't want to see people doing illegal fishing. And we even worked with the fishing industry in California to help increase penalties for poaching. That was a difficult coalition to put together, but in the end, we all did the right thing.
Talking about fishing, could we talk about the industrial fishing and the bycatch of the animals they're trying to protect? Like the turtle, we see on many, many documentaries about the level of bycatch that industrial fishing is involved in, and it's heartbreaking to see. Are there any of your protected areas that are threatened by it? Is there industrial fishing being conducted around your protected areas? How does that affect you?
Yeah. So look, first, it's just in California. There's an organization called Oceana that's done a great job of coming up with different regulations and laws, helping enact policies and laws to stop longlining gillnet fishing just off the coast of California, that it's having a significant impact on seabirds, sharks, and sea turtles. So that's been a whole series of laws and policies that Wild Coast has supported that. But really, there are groups that are focused on fishing policy that in California has been pretty successful and really important, which is why we may see the white shark population coming back, which has been pretty interesting. But in Mexico, before a lot, really starting in the 80s, you saw the industrialization of the fishing industry and the expansion of fishing. And these small-scale co-ops were getting loans from the Mexican government to buy bigger boats, and they're getting involved in fishing. And along the Pacific coast of Baja California, where you had traditionally just had small co-ops, you saw this whole movement towards more industrial scale fishing, the use of longliners, long lines to catch sharks, for example. So I was in the field with my wife doing our PhD work in the early 90s, and we'd go out fishing 20 miles offshore with these guys with long lines and to catch sharks. And just devastating to watch them reel in dozens of beautiful blue sharks, right? But that would replicate that along the entire coast of Baja California. And what had happened was there were guys from Chiapas, southern Mexico, that were moving up and systematically, basically removing sharks from the entire Pacific Mexico coastline. So, and that went on, thousands and thousands of fishermen. Then you had the shrimp boats, you had boats coming over from Asia as well. And so that has devastated probably more than anything. And the drag nets that drag the bottom. So that's probably been the most significant threat to fisheries and marine life, especially in northwest Mexico and along Mexico's Pacific coast, as well as around the world, right? And that's threatened things like long lines. I'm going to give credit to organizations like Oceana and others, and there are scientists, at Scripps and other locations that really focus on the economics of fishing and trying to crack down on overfishing. Right now, a lot of that has gone into satellites and using satellite technology to track and identify poaching activity. I think that's really important, but that's something that's critical. And just had a tremendous, devastating impact on marine biodiversity off of what's called Magdalena Bay, which is the Pacific Lagoon south of San Ignacio Lagoon. So these are giant whale lagoons where you have mangroves. All these guys are going out illegally fishing for lobster, unfortunately, in the off season using gillnets. But there were loggerhead turtles coming over from Japan and Asia and by the thousands and bobbing offshore eating pelagic red crabs. And so all of a sudden, my wife and I were noticing that there were hundreds of loggerhead turtles arriving dead on the shore. And now it's turned into this major international issue. Other organizations are involved, like the Center for Biological Diversity, and threatening boycotts against Mexico because of all this bycatch and mortality. So really devastating. Walking a beach and seeing literally dozens of dead sharks as well as sea turtles is not something I want to see all the time.
Absolutely heartbreaking.
You have to deal with industrial fishing.
Yeah. So are you collaborating with all the other NGOs into lobbying the government to reduce the devastating impact of industrial fishing on marine ecosystems, like introducing new laws in protected areas and so on?
Yeah, so, organizations, again, I think organizations like Oceana and others, NRDC in the United States have been really focused on that, on really focusing on the overfishing and bycatch in Mexico. That's been a lot more problematic. I think a lot of things have come out of the ecosystem level, which is why a lot of us are focused on ecosystem level protection, because it's a little easier to enforce those ordinances and any fishing regulations are within a protected area. But it's been very, very difficult in Mexico and other developing countries because the fishing lobby is so powerful and a lot obviously can, in more of a nationalized or centralized government like you have in Mexico, it's very much the fisheries agency is a direct arm of the federal government and unwilling and many times to have people give up jobs, right? And so that's always the trade-off, right? Like you've got these thousands of fishermen that are illegally fishing, but then, what's the alternative, right? I think that's been the challenge. In the upper Gulf of California, where you have what's called the Upper Gulf Biosphere Reserve, you have a small harbor porpoise called the vaquita marina. It's one of the most endangered marine mammals in the world, cetaceans in the world. And a fish that you see that swims with them is called the totoaba. It's a giant fish, like corvina, almost like a corvina. And the bladders are prized in Asia, as an aphrodisiac. And so the triads in China were financing the narco cartel poaching of these totoabas. And to get a totoaba, you probably are getting vaquita. And so this was going on all illegally. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service was trying to crack down on the trade that was coming up from California up to Washington, to Seattle, to go to China. And so, but it's been devastating and just had a huge impact on marine biodiversity in the Gulf of California, which is one of the world's richest and most important marine areas. So, you know, the verdict's not out on that. We've got a lot of work to do to control fishing. I think organizations like Oceana made it really clear, though, that, you know, to feed the world's growing population, we need to have fish. We need to continue to have fishing, but we need to do a lot more incentives to do it sustainably and in a way that doesn't devastate and destroy the ocean.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We also talked earlier a lot about, or a little about, the grey whales and so forth. So what are the risks that whales are potentially having within your sites?
Yeah, so it's funny. I just heard a talk. So along the coast of California, you've got things like blue whales. You've got humpback whales. They're further offshore and going between Hawaii, for example, or in Baja California, or up to the Pacific Northwest. And you've got gray whales that come from the Bering and Chukchi Sea up in the northern Pacific, up above north of Alaska, where they're feeding, mm-hmm. and then coming down along, right, and they're hugging the coast and going down to spend the winter in these beautiful mangrove fringe lagoon, desert lagoons in Baja California. And I just heard Dr. Steven Swartz, who was, I think he got his PhD, Matt, at Scripps, and he was a gray whale ecologist from San Diego, who has been a pioneer in gray whale research. And what I just saw him give a talk, and he talked about is that up to 25% of the gray whale population is threatened. They're emaciated. They're not eating enough. And so they've seen this over the last 4 years. They're not really sure why, but they think it could be because of, as sea temperatures increase in the Bering and Chukchi Sea, the whales are feeding on, with their baleen, they're going down and making pits in the bottom of the sea and feeding on amphipods, right? They're filtering the sand with their baleen and then getting these little creatures, these amphipods, to eat. And they think maybe that population is disappearing and the whales are spending more time along their migratory corridor trying to feed, which has been interesting because I've seen, you know, I've been in the water off of our coast since 1971, and it's only in the last few years that I saw baby juvenile gray whales in the surf zone. I was in Huntington Beach in the middle of Southern California, Orange County, for a life-saving competition, a lifeguard competition, and there was a juvenile gray whale in the surf zone. Like, you know, hundreds of people were actually, we were doing our lifeguard competition, there was a gray whale sort of like stuck in the surf zone. So they think that maybe gray whales are spending more of their time trying to find feeding resources along this migratory corridor, not finding enough food, and significantly suffering from the loss of body weight. So that's something we're seeing right now. You know, I just saw something about the northern right whale, Atlantic right whale population that's having being hugely impacted by overfishing and vessel activity, and is having an impact on their size, how big they are. And so that's a problem. So, you know, whales are under threat worldwide and from some of the same forces that we're seeing impacting the ocean everywhere. But one good news is things like the blue whale have come back along the coast of California. So that's good. And we're understanding more, Matt, I think you're right about the whole connectedness. People like Barbara Block, who's a famous marine biologist at Stanford University, or have this project to tag large ocean animals with lots of researchers, including from Matt's institution and La Jolla. And they're trying to track these animals to see where they go. And they're really getting an understanding of the importance of these transoceanic migratory sort of corridors and the importance of protecting them. So I think that's kind of like the future of ocean conservation, is really piecing together huge, vast areas of the ocean as protected areas to make sure that these corridors, we have big tuna, big sea turtles, big sharks, big whales, can remain, protected.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I guess on the protection of that, as we touched on earlier, is, which is very, very important, is around the mangroves and the breeding areas. And this is kind of where I bring in Matt's speciality, I guess, in this area. What have we lost, and kind of what is there a percentage we still have left? Could you give us a bit of an insight?
Sure. One study suggested that over the course of the second part of the 20th century, that the world lost about 35% globally of mangrove area. And so that's, again, that's looking at those years ending around 2001. One good news is that preliminarily, it seems that in the years since then, it's possible that the percentage rates of loss might be going down, but 35% gone is a lot. And so that's a lot from a restoration perspective. That's a lot to try to get back, and it's a big job ahead of us. But unfortunately, what I study is their carbon sequestration ability. When you lose a mangrove ecosystem or most coastal ecosystems, and if you disturb the sediment, the carbon that might have been building up there for hundreds or thousands of years, a lot of that is released, and you can't get that back by restoring it. So as much enthusiasm as we should have about restoring these ecosystems, the number one thing we have to do is not let it be 36% or 37%. We have to stop the bleeding immediately, because otherwise these ecosystems, instead of acting as the carbon sinks that they are, they become carbon sources.
Yeah.
But as you introduced this topic, carbon is just one of the many ways that these ecosystems provide important services for people, including their value as nursery habitats and providing home for a wide array of biodiversity. When I first came to Scripps thinking about studying mangroves, in my first year I was thinking I was going to do my PhD on mangroves as fish habitat, which is, I could have done that. It would have been very interesting. Mm-hmm. It's a great topic, but I ended up getting stuck in the sediment instead.
So why are we losing the mangroves? What are the factors that are pushing this obviously loss that we have?
So it's thought, and there are some recent papers that discuss this, it's thought that in some ways some of the factors have changed to some degree, and also the places in the world where the hotspots of that deforestation are happening. Especially in the later part of the 20th century, one of the really big factors that people discussed a lot and documented a lot were unsustainable coastal aquaculture. So the idea that replacing a mangrove forest with a shrimp farm or some other kind of coastal aquaculture that, mangroves are highly productive and good places for many organisms to grow, including many species of shrimp naturally use them as nursery habitats. But if you employ a model where you clear out all the trees and grow feed as many shrimp as possible to get as many shrimp out per square meter per year, you very quickly have a highly polluted and pretty destroyed environment. And then you move on to the next plot of mangroves 5 years later or 10 years later and do it again. So that led to really high rates of loss, and still going on today for sure, though there have been some successful, some wonderful success stories of people who have been made aware of the value of potentially of the carbon sequestration, for instance, value of the mangroves, and have instead shifted to a model of putting their shrimp farms offshore of the mangroves. So in some ways they're still benefiting from the ecological value of the mangroves for the shrimp, but they're also protecting the mangroves, and in so doing can apply for organic certification for the shrimp. So there is, and that ends up making more revenue to support those conservation efforts. So there are success stories. So anyway, shrimp farms is one example. There are other kinds of coastal development. Unfortunately, mangroves live on tropical coastlines where some people want to build we all like to be on tropical coastlines, myself included. And so development for various purposes, hotels and so on, you can imagine. But there are other sort of more insidious factors that are not, you can't see someone cutting down the tree, but these effects are happening. And that has a lot to do with things like sediment diversions, insufficient sediment reaching the coast, sometimes insufficient fresh water reaching the coast. Mangroves are amazing plants in that they can survive in salt water, but they their how quickly they grow and how healthy they are does in many cases partially depend on how much river flow or fresh water they receive. And so using up all of that fresh water or diverting the freshwater sediment often can lead to mass die-offs. There's an example of this happening, I think, in northern Australia a few years ago. Really, really large areas of mangroves dying off, and they think had having to do with exceptionally high drought conditions during that year. And also pollution. There is significant nutrient runoff into some coastal areas that mangroves live in that affects the growth of the plants and also algae that can live among the mangroves and potentially affect the growth conditions for the trees. And as we've seen so many pictures in recent years and probably seen it ourselves walking along the shore, there is some increasing recognition of the role of plastics and other, you know, particulate pollution that ends up in coastal ecosystems. I've been very lucky to travel to some many beautiful coastal sites, but unfortunately, too many of them have been marred by seeing, even in very remote places, pieces of plastic and other human, pieces of garbage. And so one silver lining or one positive view of this is that there is increasing evidence that there are some characteristics of the microbial communities in mangrove sediments that seem to be pretty good, actually, at breaking down pieces of plastic. There are obviously questions about what happens then, what chemicals might be released in that process. But what is good about that is that it shows that we're learning from nature. We're learning more about the ecological processes happening even on microscopic scales that we can potentially use to help start addressing these issues. So in summary, those are some of the more big picture insidious effects that are happening on these ecosystems. And of course, the number one big one on the long term is climate change. So mangroves live on the coast. They live in a very particular place between high and low tide, and that place is moving. And it's moving in some places, it's moving quickly. And so we have to think about how can we manage these ecosystems, whether through sediment controls and and various other things. How do we manage these ecosystems to give them their best shot at persisting with sea level rise and other changes that are going to happen? There's a lot of research challenges there ahead.
Indeed. Can you please explain for our viewers the importance of mangroves forests? Because there's just such a varied role that the mangroves forests have in our ecosystem.
Yeah, well, I guess I'll start out by saying all ecosystems are important, but there's one thing that's really wonderful about mangroves is that we have so many great examples that are of quantifiable, even economic benefits that we can show directly are gathered from these ecosystems. One example is the sequestration of carbon, especially as there's more interest now in carbon markets or carbon credits offsets. There's a real tangible economic benefit if you can say, okay, by restoring this mangrove or by protecting this mangrove, it's sequestered this many tons of carbon per year. That's a tangible economic value. But also by supporting fisheries, by supporting nursery habitat for many species, that has tangible economic value for the communities that fish in those waters offshore, and also not only for artisanal fisheries, but also in many cases benefit large-scale fisheries. Mangroves and other coastal ecosystems protect coastlines from erosion. So the plants, by growing in the sediment, slow down water flow, just because the plants sort of baffle the movement of water, and that by slowing down the water flow, it encourages sediment to settle down and become stabilized by the roots of those plants. Also, in many cases, mangroves actually add to the volume of the soil by adding organic matter. So it's sequestering carbon and building the soil with all that plant matter at the same time. So they're protecting coastlines from sea level rise, protect coastal areas from the impacts of wave events, tsunami, hurricanes. They're really excellent examples of how in areas of a coast that had mangroves and areas that didn't nearby, the ones that had mangroves had much fewer economic damages or even mortality after a hurricane event. So they're real. It's wonderful that there are such clear examples of how these ecosystems are providing tangible benefits to people. It's important not to forget the intangible benefits. These ecosystems have inherent value. They support lots of species. They're beautiful. They're important for many cultures around the world. They provide recreational value and scientific value. There's so much we can learn from them. So as much as the ecosystem services mindset of putting a dollar value on these things is valuable for making a political argument or affecting change, it's important not to forget that they're valuable in a way that we can't put a dollar value on.
Yeah,
exactly. Is there a strong connection between the mangrove forests and the local communities? Are there local communities around the globe that live off the mangroves?
For all the places that mangroves exist, there are probably there's a different story, right? There's a different way that each community and each ecosystem connects to it to each other. And so I won't make a general statement, but I will say that it is true that many people fish in and around mangroves and know that that's why the food that they get are there is because they grow in the mangroves. It's sort of common sense if you grow up in that environment, but it's we sit, you know, hundreds of miles away pondering, well, what could be the value of mangroves? Well, it's obvious when you get your dinner by walking down and grabbing a shellfish or something.
Yeah.
But not just for seafood. Also, there are many places that sustainably derive wood products from mangroves. There are examples of sustainable forestry and mangroves that have been going on for decades or longer. There are other plant products, including there are some mangrove bark that's used for creating certain dyes and so on. So there's a whole wonderful field of understanding the ethnobotany, so the traditional uses of those plants that you can go into and study. And there's a rich study of this. But and of course many peoples around the world recognize the physical protection that mangroves provide, knowing where to live and where to be protected from storms. So for as many places there are mangroves, there are different unique ways that communities relate to them. And so I think one of the great value of the style of conservation that organizations like Wild Coast do is by working with people on the ground in those places and figuring out what do they want and need. You know, there's a risk in conservation biology, especially in academics, scientists, of people kind of showing up, doing something, getting some data, and maybe then writing a paper saying, here's what you should do, but it doesn't connect to the reality of people on the ground. So there's no substitute for doing this work in a way that's in constant communication and dialogue with the people who are most likely to benefit from that place and to positively affect it, which are the people who live there.
So are there any animals that are endangered because of the reduction in mangrove forests that you know of? What biodiversity have we lost?
Well, that's a good question. I think that's a tough question. I would say mangroves themselves, there are not that many species of mangroves. They're only naturally in any, let's say in Mexico, for instance, there's three or four species. And so they're still all there. You know, the total area of mangroves has decreased, but the creatures that live there, probably are reduced by that fraction. But I think that the answer to that question is there's significant reductions in the productivity of those ecosystems when we lose these mangrove areas. So if you had 100 acres of mangroves last year and 50 this year, you're going to get 50% fewer fish that you can catch that depend on those. And I think that's the story there, that the ripples of those effects to the ecosystem can spread quite widely because many species that spend their time in the mangroves become important parts of the ecosystem, including offshore. I guess one example I can think of a species that is very endangered that depends on mangroves is a endangered species of finch in the Galapagos Islands. It's a great, wonderful natural history example. Anytime you could talk about finches in the Galapagos Islands, But there's this one of the many diverse groups of finches in the Galapagos lives only in mangroves, and only in a couple of the islands, in fact. And they're extremely endangered. And so every last square foot of those mangroves is essential habitat for these birds. And I think that, you know, that's a very specific example, and it took many years of study to figure that out. And so I think an important lesson to remember is how many of these unique ecological connections between species don't we know about? And we'll never know if that particular mangrove in that particular place is gone, that species connection or those set of connections might be gone, and we'll never know. So I think that points to the importance of research, and also points to the importance of protecting what we have, because we could lose things we'll never know we had otherwise.
One thing I was going to say, that in Baja California, what you see in the Gulf of California and the Pacific is that where you have the mangroves are in a good condition, or coral reefs, for example, are in good condition, you see a lot more biodiversity, you see a lot more fish, you know, especially in fisheries, abundance, right? That's especially the case in Magdalena Bay. And where you see degradation, you see a lot less resources. And of course, that's the case in wetlands in California, where you've gotten a lot of degradation and you've seen a loss of fisheries for a number of reasons. But definitely, you can really see that in what's called Magdalena Bay. It's an embayment over 200 kilometers long in southern Baja on the Pacific coast, and just a whole series of extensive mangrove fringed embayments. But it's the most important fisheries area of southern Baja California, a state. And just an incredible richness of shellfish, for example, around mangroves. There's actually one species of shellfish that people get within the mangroves, right? You can see these guys harvesting it. But I think that's been part of the issue, is to really make sure that you, as Matt said, we protect the places that are already there, because they're such an important indicator of abundance and what, where you see the wildlife, and then getting rid of them is when you start seeing things fall apart.
So we talked and touched on the CO2 sequestration, and it seemed to be a bit of a big topic at the moment as well. There's different ways to how people feel about carbon offsetting and so forth, but could you describe what is the sequestration and the, I guess, the blue carbon project?
Well, I can speak to the general idea of what do we mean by carbon sequestration in these ecosystems. The way I like to describe this is hundreds of millions of years ago, there were some trees growing in swamps, and there was some phytoplankton growing in coastal oceans, and they took up carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere to make, that's what they do by photosynthesis, to make more plant matter or phytoplankton. And they sank into the seafloor, or they sank into the swamps, and were buried by sediments. And over many millions of years, that organic carbon became the fossil fuels that we burn today. So coal is ancient tree matter, ancient plant matter, and gas and natural gas and oil are derived from to a large degree from plankton and coastal oceans. And so blue carbon is not a new thing. We think of it as kind of a new buzzword, but it's as old as you know, the dinosaurs and older. What we're doing now is taking this organic matter that's been buried for millions of years and burning it for energy and returning it to the atmosphere. And so by framing it that way, I think we can see why it's important to highlight, okay, what ecosystems today are doing that same job that formed those deposits millions of years ago? Because if we can understand how those ecosystems work, and at doing that same process of taking carbon out of the atmosphere and putting it someplace where it will stay out of the atmosphere for a very long time, we can understand how to protect them, how to allow them to do that, continue doing that, or even to do it even better, more rapidly. And that's where these ecosystems provide hope as a natural solution to climate change. So that's what mangrove ecosystems and other coastal wetlands, also seagrass beds, are especially good at, is like any plant, they take carbon out of the environment to grow. But what's special about them is that some fraction of that carbon gets buried in sediments. Those sediments build up over many, many years and form a deposit that keeps the carbon in the ground.
Yeah. You know, we were lucky enough to interview Adam Brancher from the Southern Ocean Carbon Company a while ago, which makes it sound like it's all about carbon, but really, he is growing vast sea kelp farms, off the southern ocean, and the details that he was talking about in terms of how fast they grow, but also how much carbon they sequester, was astonishing. I mean, some species of kelp were growing, you know, half a meter a day, which is an astonishing rate. And it was great to understand how vastly important this is. You know, we all see trees, and we expect trees are the main thing that do it, but there's so many other areas. And I think it's great that we're slowly starting to be able to, A, tell more people, and other people start to understand more and more about other areas that we can sequester carbon, and is the natural process.
Yeah, so, you know, and I think Matt's done a great job of explaining and working on the issue of the sequestration. And then I think the Blue Carbon Project that Wild Coast is engaged in and partnering with Matt and others is really, I'm going to pull back a little bit to look at the whole planet, and really comes out of, I think, the concern by conservationists worldwide that when you had meetings, you know, iterations of the Paris Climate Treaty before the Paris Climate Treaty, you know, there's a focus on mitigation, you know, emissions reductions, focused on industrial activities, giving lip service to the role of green and blue carbon. So forests, as well as, you know, the sequestration of forests, tropical forests especially, and then also almost completely ignoring the role that these blue carbon ecosystems play in mitigating emissions, right, sequestering carbon, as well as the adaptation piece, helping us deal with sea level rise and damage from storms, especially in tropical country and developing or third world countries, mm-hmm. where these ecosystems, whether they're tropical forests or, you know, blue carbon ecosystems, were being eviscerated. So for Wild Coast, that started in Mexico with the support of the German government, the German Development Assistance Foreign Assistance Program through the Mexican National Park Service. And before we really understood the role of the sequestration of mangroves, the carbon sequestration, really focusing on protecting their climate adaptation or sea level rise adaptation sort of power, superpowers, right? Like the fact that if Mexico is going to help be able to address sea level rise and coastal storms and coastal flooding, they need to protect these existing mangrove ecosystems. And then lo and behold, thanks to the research of Matt and his colleagues, especially Octavio Berto and a whole other group of scientists, we started learning about the carbon sequestration superpowers of these mangroves. And I think the recognition that even at the Paris Climate Treaty and these big multilateral institutions were ignoring, and especially governments like Mexico and others, especially in Latin America and the developing world, were ignoring in these agreements for dealing with natural climate solutions, the issue of mangroves. And so that's why you've seen, I think, a global movement, and that's encapsulated by this Blue Carbon Project in Mexico and California that Matt has been working on with Wild Coast and others, is to just to solidify the protection of mangroves and other wetland ecosystems that sequester carbon, and then to get the governments to acknowledge that these are important for carbon adaptation and mitigation needs. And not the only answer, right? And part of a multi sort of package of what we need to do to address climate change, but that it's indispensable. We can't not address climate change. To address climate change, we have to also protect these ecosystems for their adaptation and mitigation needs. And so in California, that's also brand new, right? Like what Matt's working on in terms of helping identify help us understand the sequestration of carbon in coastal wetlands is important because, for example, the county of San Diego that has the Climate Action Plan doesn't actually acknowledge the importance of the carbon sequestration that goes on in wetlands in our own backyard, and they're doing offset projects, maybe in a wind farm in Kansas, rather than actually using its own power to protect these wetlands. And so that, I think that's something important. So it's twofold: to get governments to understand the need to protect these areas and why they're important, and number two, to get people to understand them and protect them. So in Mexico, that's critical because up until recently, really the federal government there was no formal protection for mangroves. And so that's where we're really going, is to making sure that there are federal laws aimed at the protection of mangroves, and that Mexico understands, for example, that it should be cutting deals with John Kerry and others, you know, our climate envoy, to get money from, you know, these multilateral institutions to set aside mangroves, and so local communities can actually get paid to protect them. That's that's where the whole natural climate solutions framework needs to happen on a global level, especially with mangroves. So they're incentivizing people to protect these areas. Unfortunately, in Mexico right now, through there's been some problems with that system in which the government's paid people to, in theory, protect forests, but they're actually cutting them down. So, you know, nothing works perfectly. But right now, I feel like we're in a race against time to make sure that we can get people to value mangroves. And I think Matt's right. Look, they're important for their own sake. But I finally feel like these forgotten backyard habitats, because, you know, let's be real. Up until recently, people didn't care about mangroves. The people who lived around them did. But hotel developers didn't, shrimp farm developers didn't, and government ministers and faraway capitals didn't. Nor did, you know, did we care much about them in California, where we've lost 90% of our coastal wetlands. And so I think a lot of us have finally said, okay, hopefully there's one more reason we can give people to protect these blue carbon ecosystems, which I think is still a pretty cool name. I love it. I think blue carbon, it could be a rock band, right? Like, I think it's actually pretty cool. Good movie. Whatever it takes to do conservation. Yeah. But finally to say, and I think people have gotten really excited about this, is like, hey, here are these cool scientists. They're discovering that this backyard habitat, literally next to an urban area, is going to help us save the planet. You want to help us do that? Like, that's actually pretty cool. Right. I think people are getting into that idea, and we're seeing a lot of interest in that. So we've got this Blue Carbon Collaborative in California. We're forming alliances in Mexico and trying to have a more Latin American sort of network of people working on blue carbon. But I feel like we're in a race against time, mm-hmm. and that, you know, whatever it takes to do conservation and protect the planet, we need to do. And it's clear that mangroves are going to help us get there, and that they are definitely worthy of our protection. In addition, not only, but to help us protect against increasing hurricanes and storms we're seeing in tropical areas.
Absolutely, absolutely. So as we've held you, and you're both very, very busy people, and we've held you for quite a substantial amount of time. We've got a last couple of questions, which are almost kind of like a quick fire sort of questions that we ask everybody. Don't panic. There's no wrong answer. So if we go through, I think Anchor, yours is the first one.
I think we were trying to find out about any exciting projects that you're doing at the moment. You have said something just at the beginning of the interview. Are you able to share any of your new projects with Wild Coast?
The one you were saying about with Pierce Brosnan on the phone and so forth, as you do, everybody has actors on the phone all the time, don't they?
Yeah. So right now, Wild Coast is working with a variety of organizations, including NRDC and IFA and others, on a film called Who Saved the Whale Lagoon? And it'll be a feature-length documentary project on the really groundbreaking and innovative efforts back in the late 90s to preserve San Ignacio Lagoon, this UNESCO World Heritage Site in Gray Whale Lagoon, against the Mitsubishi Corporation at that time when they turned the whole area into an industrial salt mining facility. And Pierce Brosnan, who was then James Bond, played a really important role in that campaign and became a spokesperson. I was just emceed a Zoom call where he really eloquently and passionately talked about just how important it was to protect that place, his role in it, and more importantly, why, you know, he feels that protecting the planet is important, right? It was actually, and obviously he really cares about it. So I think it's important to communicate to people the importance of conservation, but also how to do it. And we play mangroves into that because now, you know, thanks to scientists like Matt and his colleagues, we now have a reason to protect the mangroves around San Ignacio Lagoon. So the argument is, you know, environmentalists and local fishermen and whale watching guides help save the lagoon, and now the lagoon's going to help save the planet. So I think that's something I'm really excited about.
Fantastic. Sounds awesome.
What does Wild Coast need to continue this successful story? What are your needs at the moment?
Yeah, so, you know, Wild Coast, like any organization, needs people to donate at wildcoast.org. We always need your support. But, you know, I think we need people to care and really get involved and you know, and understanding they can make a difference and helping, and this maybe protecting your backyard habitats, right? Like every inch of blue and green space matters. So get involved in conservation. Help do a beach cleanup. You know, help protect your local nature reserve, right? You can make a difference. We can save the planet. And I think, you know, getting everybody engaged is what's going to get us through this and get to the other side so we can win the climate crisis.
So I'll put this one to both of you. So if we go with Matthew first, understanding the climate emergency, what keeps you up at night?
It's a good question. I would say there's a concept that I've discussed with some of the other graduate students. When I was a graduate student here and I was a postdoc, you know, we're all working on these issues that are kind of larger than life. You know, how is climate change affecting ecosystems? How are these huge, slow changes happening? And unfortunately, the more you learn about it and the more you're involved in it, the more you see that the world is changing. There are some things that are not going to be the same, you know, when I'm old than the way it was when I was a kid. And the challenge is to, I think, just like Serge said, I think is so important, is getting people out into the environment, participating in a restoration project, getting their feet dirty or their hands dirty is really important, because building those connections between people and their natural environments is, I think, at the beginning of all of this. But the scary thing is the conflict between building those connections and then recognizing that those connections are going to change. You know, we have to be not only forging connections between people and nature, but also learning for those connections to be resilient. And even just in our culture and in our appreciation of nature, how do we get used to a changing world and having their connection with the ecosystems, that knowing that we have to continue adapting over the course of the 21st century? So it's a big, big challenge.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So Serge, what aspects would make you optimistic for the future?
Well, you know, one thing I get really excited about is, you know, for years, I think decades, you know, scientists were in the ivory tower, right? Like, you know, that we're focused on building the blocks of knowledge in the wall of knowledge. And, you know, this idea of being separate from policy and activism and, you know, conservation. But we've seen a big shift out in climate scientists and, you know, conservation biologists, et cetera, and oceanographers and marine scientists, for example, in the world that I work in, we've made a real strategic commitment and focused commitment to helping make a difference. And so I really think that we've been aided, and I really am inspired by Matt and his colleagues at the Center for Climate Change and Impact and Adaptation at Scripps Institute of Oceanography, who partner with organizations like Wild Coast and others, and then have a really big impact on policy. Like, it can actually use their science to inform policy and make some difference. That's going to help us. And I think the people that are really great at doing the science, but also articulating it to policymakers, are really helping us a lot and getting that science quickly into the hands of people who can make a difference. But also, you know, the tragedy that we went through the last year and a half, is it a year and a half or over a year, mm-hmm. is at least what we showed is that if we want to do things quickly, we can. Yeah. If we want to work together, we can. We're still not even close to being there yet, but we're going to have to figure that out a lot more quickly. And so I'm optimistic that if we choose to, we can address this. It's actually not that complicated, but we have to have the political will. It's amazing what people can do when they choose to. And there's an esteemed scientist at Scripps, Walter Monk, one of the godfathers of oceanography. And I was with him before he passed away. I think was he 101, I think, when he passed away, right? And anyways, I was with Octavio Berto, Matt's professor. And Walter Monk was talking about, he helped do the wave forecasting to help plan the D-Day invasion, right? He was a scientist that helped develop what wave forecasting was. And, you know, we were talking, he says, never underestimate the power of what a small group of people can do, right? Like, you know, and he was, you know, and Matt, you know what it was like, right? Like, it was like, I was like, yes, thank you, right? You know, if you look at what humans have done over the time eternal, we can do some pretty amazing things, and we're going to have to work a lot harder and a lot faster and a lot smarter, but we can do that, right? So that's what keeps me optimistic. Yeah. And also just getting out in the water and realizing that, damn, it's a beautiful place. We need to protect it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think the comment in that vein from Walter Monk, who is a great, I was very lucky to share my time at Scripps with on this topic, was he went as a scientist working in the war effort in World War II. He recognized that there were amazing advancements in oceanography and all kinds of technology, because much of the Western world was focused on this huge existential threat in World War II, and so he saw that and saw that we need to have that kind of attitude today. We have to recognize that we're be on sort of a war footing with regard to these global challenges, we have to recognize that there's no other choice but to get through this. And so awakening everyone's awareness to the huge challenges ahead of us, but not losing the joy and enthusiasm, as we've been saying, of appreciating the coast is hopefully our best path forward.
And finally, this is a question for both of you. If there is anything you could ask our listeners to do to save the planet, what would it be? How can it be good?
My first advice is almost always something which Serge mentioned before is get involved in your immediate environment. I think this is really a long-term solution because thinking about the next generation is the number one way to get people to care about nature is to get people, especially kids, because children are all scientists and then we teach them not to be as we grow up, to get kids outside, learning by doing, especially, you know, engaging in projects like restoration projects or cleanups, but recognizing that nature is an amazing laboratory to learn things in and to discover the universe, and also to recognize that it's a place that we affect with our everyday lives. So I think outdoor education and getting kids and the young at heart out into nature is, in the long term, I think the best solution, in my opinion.
Absolutely.
Yeah, look, I'm going to echo what Matt said. I think, you know, getting people out in nature, getting people, you know, volunteer to protect nature at your local backyard habitat or reserve or at your beach. Get your kids out in nature. For God's sake, put your phone away when you're doing it. If I see another parent staring at their screen when their kids are playing at the beach. But, you know, we need to rewire our brains back into the blue and the green, right? And so I think, you know, I think that's more important than ever. And I think when you do that, you have hope, right? Like, it's if we're all doing that, that gives us hope. It shows us what we can do, because it's easy to throw up our arms and say we can't do anything, but we can make a difference and we can see things get better. We can help nature get better, right? We can recover nature. And I think that's more important than ever.
Absolutely. It has been an absolute pleasure to have you both on the show, and it's a delight to listen to your wealth of knowledge and experience. And yeah, I'd just like to say thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Well, thank you guys. We appreciate having you.
Yeah,
not
really
a problem.
Nice conversation.
What a fantastic interview that was. It was so good to listen to all the things that both Matt and Serge have done and are doing, and the amazing efforts that they're making to retain what is our so precious natural resources.
Indeed, and I was surprised that their work continued throughout the last 4 years, and they haven't stopped, they didn't put a stop despite the challenges, the political challenges that they've had to face. As you said before, half of their volunteers and the charity is in Mexico, and having to deal with this, trying to sustain the same level of presence and of efforts in Mexico and the States with the wall in the middle has been challenging, but they are still doing it. And the people that are committed to this, they never gave up. They never stopped.
Yeah. I thought it was very important what Serge said about, unfortunately, we have the media and movies depicting a certain vision of Mexico and so forth. And that's not how he has seen it in the least. It's very different. They're very inclusive. They're very hardworking and looking to make the environment better on many, many different fronts.
We are going to put all the details on our show and on our website. Please donate, please join in. If you live close, please volunteer. Get in touch with Serge. We'll put and Matt. We'll put all their details on our show notes as well, and see how you can get involved to save the beautiful, beautiful areas that they're trying to maintain and conserve.
Absolutely. And as always, we always look forward to your comments and reviews. And if you're watching on YouTube, because we're there now, then hit the subscribe and bell button to get notified when new podcasts come up. And we look forward to seeing you, hearing from you, and to the next show. Take care.
Bye-bye. Bye.